From 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect Weekend. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. Today on the show, the Milwaukee Health Department is moving to a grading system for Milwaukee restaurants in hopes of making dining out a safer experience.
Every year we do a food safety report and we analyze the percent of routine inspections that had a priority or a critical violation. And those numbers have been creeping up, and we haven't had a decrease in foodborne illness in the city of Milwaukee as far back as we can see. And so we really needed to come up with an innovative system to make dining in the city of Milwaukee safer.
Then why you shouldn't be afraid if your doctor seems to be improvising when they see you.
In improv, theatrically, we say follow the unexpected, follow the unusual. When there's something that's just different in what was said or done, usually that's the interesting place to go. And often that's true in medicine also.
And we'll have the latest episode of our storytelling series, Ex Fabula. Lake Effect Weekend comes your way next after this news update from NPR. This is Lake Effect Weekend from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks for joining us. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Bonnie North. There are more than two decades worth of local restaurant inspection reports on the City of Milwaukee's Health Department website. So if you want to know how your favorite eatery stacks up, you can look them up, see how they've done with health inspections in the past, and see the kinds of violations, if any, that they've received. But the reports can be confusing, and they're full of jargon that's generally unfamiliar to those of us who are not health inspectors.
The Health Department wanted to change that, and as of this year, those inspection reports will be translated into grades. So just like in school, an A will represent few or no violations, with Bs and Cs meaning more or many violations.
Soon, these grades will be on display in restaurants throughout Milwaukee, and that's thanks to a new system developed by UWM students and implemented by Milwaukee's Health Department. Claire Evers is the Director of Consumer Environmental Health for the department. She talked with Lake Effect's Joy Powers to explain how the new grading system compares with what was in place before.
So there's a couple important things. The actual regulations did not change. So operators can expect that their inspections are based off of the same criteria as they were before. It's the Wisconsin Food Code that we enforce. So that hasn't changed. What has changed is the inspection report, the violations will be associated with a point value, and then they will be given a grade, an A, B, or a C, or potentially temporarily closed, depending on what their inspection findings were.
Okay. How does that differ from what was in place before? So instead of a point system, what
sure.
was there?
So we didn't grade inspections before. So the inspector would go out and they would conduct their inspection, and then they would issue an inspection report, which would list what the violations were. But we didn't grade it. We didn't issue it any sort of point value before.
And how could consumers get those kinds of reports?
Sure. So we do have our inspections reports online. We have been doing that for years. So you can go to our website, and there's a link to find inspection reports, and you can find them. They're in two different segments. Prior to January of 2017, there's a link, and then post-January of 2017, there's another link.
Okay. So they were accessible online, but
right.
say you went into a restaurant and you wanted to know what their health inspections had been like previously, there wasn't the same kind of transparency. How does that new system change that?
Sure. So an inspection report is really complicated, and it has a lot of technical jargon. So it's kind of hard for someone who isn't in the food service industry or the regulatory area to understand 100% what the risk is associated with the violations. There's a point value assigned to each type of violation. So the FDA categorizes them as priority, which are the most severe, priority foundation, which are the intermediate, and then the core, which are the least severe. And so there's a point value associated. So the consumer can see if there is a lower grade, they had a lot more severe violations. And when you just read that report, sometimes people may not understand what that is.
So as someone who probably would read one of these reports and not know what that is, how do the grades really translate those reports?
So I would say by the point value. So if it is a critical or a priority violation, it is a violation worth 5 points. The report actually will say a priority violation, and the report will also say what the point value is.
And what's an example of a priority violation?
Sure. So like the most critical, that would be if an operator is using their bare hands to handle ready-to-eat food. That's a priority violation. Or failing to wash their hands at the appropriate time.
So let's say I'm going into a restaurant, it has an A rating or a B rating or a C rating. What can I glean from those kinds of, from that kind of information?
So you can have violations and still be in the A category because there is a large number of regulations that operators must adhere to. So you can have violations and still be in an A rating, but you can expect that they are still a highly compliant operator. If you find someone in the B or the C category, you may see that they have more challenges with their compliance. And the reason that we have the grade system is so that consumers then can make their determination on what they would risk. So we did have focus groups, and we asked them, you know, would you still frequent your favorite establishment if they ended up with a B or a C? And there was a large number that said, you know, if it was my favorite place and I loved the food there, I would risk it. So we want the consumers to be able to make that determination for themselves.
So what have restaurant owners said about the new system, especially compared to the old inspection kind of system?
So we did have a food safety advisory committee that had been meeting for several years, and one of the topics was the food grading system. So we did get their input on the type of a system that they thought would be fair and equitable. And then we also did have operator information sessions before the grading system went live. So last fall, early December, we had these operator information sessions. So we had seven of them. We had them in English and in Spanish, and we had almost 300 people attend. The grading system was overwhelmingly supported. I think we had one individual, and their only complaint was that they thought the categories were too broad. So we had people thanking us that we were doing this and happy that we're holding people to the same standards and that hopefully we can be improving the health of those who dine in the city of Milwaukee by having the system. Our rates of violations have been increasing over the years. So every year we do a food safety report and we analyze the percent of routine inspections that had a priority or a critical violation. And those numbers have been creeping up. And we haven't had a decrease in foodborne illness in the city of Milwaukee as far back as we can see. And so we really needed to come up with an innovative system to make dining in the city of Milwaukee safer. You know, after researching cities across the nation that have systems like this and have data that support that they have reduced foodborne illness and critical risk factors, we developed this system.
So what do you hope is the ultimate outcome? In a perfect world, what happens as a result of this?
Right. We really hope that operators are really taking control of their establishments and really working on their compliance. And we have seen that already this year. I mean, this just went live a couple weeks ago. And I just got an email today from an inspector who she had an establishment that had its challenges. It had, you know, 12, 15 violations last couple times she was there. So in December, she went and talked to the operator. She said, we're starting grading. You really need to get on board. Here's our self-inspection checklist. Do some trainings with your operators. And she went out there yesterday and they got an A. And so, you know, it's really hoping that operators are taking food safety seriously and making the improvements that they need.
Yeah, what will the rollout look like? When can we expect to see these grades really posted in restaurants?
So right now, I would say about 30% that we've seen so far have posted the grades just in the last couple weeks. It's not going to be required until 2019, and it won't be until that 2019 routine inspection. So inspections happen throughout the year. So if you aren't inspected until June 2019, we'll be able to see that placard posted.
Claire Evers is the Director of Consumer Environmental Health for the City of Milwaukee's Health Department, which worked with a team of UWM students to create the new grading system.
Andrew Lockowitz is one of those students from UWM's Executive MBA program. He was the project manager for the team of students who came up with this new grading system, and he went into more detail with Joy Powers about how the system evolved.
Well, it's really a project that we got involved with as part of the Executive MBA program at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee, and really looking to partner with the City of Milwaukee in determining how we can help move this program forward to create and establish a system for health sanitation grades at the local restaurants.
So this is something the city had already been working on a little bit, right?
Yes, there's a tremendous amount of work that went into it before we became involved. And really our involvement is there's a unique element of the EMBA program at UWM called the Integrative Management Project, or IMPs. And that's really where our involvement is. It's almost a capstone project for really for the curriculum.
Can you give me an example of some of the standards that we're talking about and how the points work?
Sure. So the type of standards would be, for example, you know, holding food at a certain temperature. That's what the inspectors would go. They measure, and then either it has been held at a certain temperature or it hasn't. Then in that case, if there was a violation, there would be a certain point total deducted, let's say 5 or 2 points from your base of 100. The way that I believe that the system implemented in Milwaukee is really differentiated from other communities that have implemented like systems is the really the ability to earn points back. So in Milwaukee, when you have a violation, you have points deducted. You'll have an opportunity to earn a certain amount of those points back based on the timeliness and thoroughness of which you resolve that finding. The other element is that it doesn't look at just a single point in time or snapshot in time. The final grade is calculated by a weighted average of the most recent three inspections. So again, those are two key elements that I believe really differentiates Milwaukee's algorithm from some other communities.
When we're saying algorithm, is that really what we mean, that we're not only looking at the one point in time calculation, but a number of health inspections? Is that what we mean with the algorithm?
That's exactly right. When we were going through this process, a lot of the feedback that we received from restaurant operators was a bit of that concern, you know, that you're only looking at a snapshot in time, and then to really make that transparent to the community may not be the best system. So we really took all that feedback, embraced it, and then worked to adapt the algorithm in a way that would still meet the integrity and the intent of the process while also taking some of those logistical factors into account.
What is the benefit of having the placard? In your analysis of other cities, you found that it was, in fact, quite beneficial.
It is. So, again, it makes it very transparent. So it's very easy. You're walking down the street. You're walking down Wisconsin Avenue. You know, you look at the grade posted on the window of the establishment, for example. That's just one more variable that you can take into account when determining where it is that you want to go to dine that afternoon or that evening. And we have seen that in the research we've done, the other communities that have implemented similar systems, they have also seen real revenue increases. There has been a percentage increase of revenues that have been gained for restaurants that have been performing well under the system. And I would assume that, you know, most all of the restaurants that are operating in Milwaukee would fall into that similar line.
Can you put a number to the violations you could have and still have an A, or the violations you would have to get a B? Or does it depend on the severity of the violation?
I think it's a combination of all of that, and it's very difficult to tell. And I think, again, which is the differentiating feature of the algorithm, is that it takes the weighted average of your most recent three inspections. It takes into account, again, the timeliness and thoroughness of which any violations have been identified. So that's really going to vary a bit operator to operator in many cases. So it's not necessarily a one-for-one. The algorithm that drives this system actually takes many variables into account, again, to try to make it as objective and really keep the integrity of the system in place.
So in theory, if there's an establishment, a restaurant, that has had a number of the same violation, they're going to get a worse grade if they continue to not fix the issue than a restaurant who has a new violation of this same type.
That's correct, and that's actually an excellent point that you raise. As part of the algorithm, there is an element where if you do have a repeat violation, there is no opportunity to earn points back in that case. Because, again, the intent of the system is try to, again, continue establishing environments that mitigate the risk of foodborne illness outbreak. So, again, if that's one element where we can focus on making sure that, you know, things are going to happen. Things will be identified. But then the key is, are we putting measures in place to be able to prevent that from occurring again in the future? And again, that's really the spirit behind this, not to be punitive, but to really help facilitate improving the environment at which we can mitigate foodborne illness outbreak risk.
Well, Andrew, thank you so much for joining us here on Lake Effect and speaking with me today.
Well, thank you.
Andrew Lockowitz is a student from UWM's Executive MBA program. He led the project to create the new health grading system for Milwaukee restaurants. We also heard earlier from Claire Evers, the Director of Consumer Environmental Health for the City of Milwaukee's Health Department. They spoke with Joy Powers.
We'll take a quick break now and then learn how improvisational theater intersects with the practice of medicine. And yes, it's a good thing. That's when Lake Effect Weekend continues in a moment on Milwaukee's NPR.
Lake Effect Weekend continues on WUWM. I'm Mitch Teich.
And I'm Bonnie North. Professor Katie Watson is a classic polymath, a case of how many hats can one person wear well. She's a lawyer, having clerked in the federal judiciary and practiced public interest law. She's also an ethicist, who's completed fellowships in clinical medical ethics and medical humanities. And she's also an adjunct faculty member at Chicago's Second City Theater's Training Center.
And that does not count her day job as a professor of law, ethics, and humanities at Northwestern University. And because she needs to keep her sense of humor, she practices what she teaches, regularly performing stand-up improv comedy.
She found time in that busy schedule to present at the most recent medical humanities lecture at the Medical College of Wisconsin, and she stopped by the Lake Effect studio while she was here. She began by explaining why you shouldn't be fearful that your doctor is improvising.
So medical improv is the adaptation of theatrical improvisation, skills, and insights, and using what's so essential about that and what overlaps with medicine to help train clinicians be better clinicians. So while patients might not like the idea of improv in medicine, the first thing I'd say is that shows a lack of understanding of how much of medicine is spontaneous. It doesn't mean it's unprepared. It means it's formatted to be just for you. And that's what you want, right? When we talk about individualized medicine, it's not from a cookbook. It's not a cookie cutter. And so physicians need to be trained, and nurses and all other clinicians, to not just respond to what they think is going to happen, but to respond to what is actually happening and what is unique about you. And those are the kind of skills that improv can teach.
When you talk about improv from a theatrical perspective, you're talking about two or more actors getting together and not having a script.
Yes.
And so you're talking, in the case of medicine then, about deviating from the expected script of, like, I come to you, Dr. So-and-so, and I'm presenting with, like, a heart palpitations or shortness of breath or something. There might be something else going on. I mean, the first thing you might think of, oh, she's having a heart attack, but it might not be that. And so is what you're talking about with the improv of training clinicians to say, wait a minute, let's step back just a minute here and see what's actually happening?
Yes, there's two essential pieces to it. So the one is when you say that actors come to improv and just make everything up. Of course, that's exactly what we do. But we're not blank slates. We're not newborn babies. We bring to stage every bit of information we've gathered over our lives, every bit of experience, every person we've ever met, and we pick and choose what to bring to stage based on the moment, not pre-planned, but not unprepared, if that makes sense.
Yes.
And so your physician comes to you with that same knowledge bank of medicine, but also that same knowledge bank of people and moments and situations, right? And of the complexities of the hospital and healthcare generally. And what you want is for them to be able to spontaneously reformat all that information as appropriate. Right? So that's one aspect, to take everything they already brought about your heart palpitations and your shortness of breath and your age and gender and fill in whatever else and bring that all appropriately. So that's one thing. The second thing is the preparation for the unexpected. Because, you know, you and I didn't know what we were going to say to one another, but we have cultural scripts that say, you're the interviewer, we're having a conversation in a radio station, there are certain things we would think would be shocking or inappropriate in this moment, right? We still have expectations, even though we don't have scripts. So to be able to learn when to let go of your expectation, to learn to look for those surprises. So in improv, theatrically, we say follow the unexpected, follow the unusual. When there's something that's just different in what was said or done, usually that's the interesting place to go. And often that's true in medicine also. So say you present with all those symptoms. There is a likely diagnosis. You know, you go down your differential and you could say, what, I'm ruling things out. But when you do what we call deep listening, meaning I'm not just listening to the content of your words, I'm listening to how you said it, I'm listening to your body language, I'm listening to your facial expressions, I'm listening to your silence, I'm listening to how what you quote-unquote say as I am speaking as well, I might get more information that says, I'm thinking about domestic violence right now. I'm thinking about all the other reasons a woman might come to the emergency room in the middle of the night rather than stay in bed and wait till morning. I'm thinking about a whole host of other things. Who brought you here? Why did you come in a taxi? You know, a whole host of other things. It doesn't mean I'm going to ignore your primary complaint, but means that I see you as a whole person. I see your social context, or at least I have curiosity to inquire about what I don't see and understand that's a closed door, not a blank space.
One of the things that comes to mind as we're talking about this is that doctors and other medical professionals are so time crunched.
Mm-hmm.
How do you train them with this work to trust their guts? That's kind of what you're asking them to do in 15 seconds.
Well, in 15 seconds, your gut is the best tool you have. Right? Because gathering an encyclopedic amount of information will not be possible. And so this is not fly by the seat of your pants, cut corners sort of training. The idea is the difference between efficient communication and rushed communication. Rushed communication says, I have to go through the whole encyclopedia and we have 15 seconds. I guess I'm just going to yammer at you. Efficient communication says, I am going to use all my training, all my experience, and all my instincts to hone in on that one thing. You said that thing that didn't make sense. I'm going to go to the thing that didn't make sense to me rather than everything that does make sense. I am comfortable with ambiguity and complexity, and I know sometimes if I go there first, I get to what turns out to be our destination, whether it's predictable or surprising, faster.
That comfort with ambiguity is something that humans really aren't.
Not our jam.
No, we don't like it. And so I know from your training with Second City and doing the kind of theatrical improv that you do, you get more comfortable with it. How are you working with doctors and other medical professionals to get them more comfortable with not knowing? Doctors are supposed to know everything.
I know. So we put them between this rock and a hard place where we say, you have to know everything. You have to have it memorized. You have to be perfect all the time. And then if they make a mistake or want to take more time or tell us, well, I'm not sure, you know, we freak out. But at the same time, when they don't do those things, there's a rush to judgment, right? They're like, I know what it is. I'll ignore those three symptoms that don't fit the diagnosis and move on. And so I think we all need to understand we're all human beings operating in complex spaces, doing our best. And for clinicians, and I work largely with medical students, but I work with experienced clinicians as well. And the experienced clinicians know this. It's just harder to want to own and embrace to say, well, you've got to do both. You've got to be in our spaces where we do memorization and we do have answers and you have to master those. And then you simultaneously have to have the other foot in this unknown and ambiguous place. So improv, think of it like, I don't want to use the word therapy, but like immersion therapy, where you say, if you're afraid of heights, maybe let's spend some time on a bridge with very good railings to just, you know, get used to this. Improv, you are put in spaces of not knowing and ambiguity and chaos, and you are asked to stay there and work through it, but in a very low stakes environment. So with my students and my clinicians, we're not performing for audiences. The stakes couldn't be lower. It doesn't matter whether you, quote, succeed or fail. It doesn't matter. And yet we're people, so we want to do well, right? And my point to them is, if you can succeed in this space where you really didn't know anything, what if you were totally prepared and had trained all your life for this? And then you use these skills. Think how successful you will be. So it is partly about naming it and saying, we don't like this. Identify in yourself your own habits of premature closure or forcing people into types because you need them to fit in their boxes. Or if you've become rigid in your roles in a way that's not productive for patient care, can you identify that first, where your Achilles heel is? And then second, can you work on it in a safe space? So I think of medical improv as cross-training. You know, why does the marathoner do sit-ups? That doesn't look like running. Well, those muscles are going to help when you are running. We don't do medical scenarios. We talk about the links, but it's not like we're acting out doctor-patient encounters. We're really doing modified theatrical improv, the idea being to train you that when you are in this other medical space, that you've got those muscles you built in this cross-training to add to all your content knowledge in those ambiguous, chaotic situations.
You said you're not using medical scenarios in this. There are a lot of actors who are pretending to be patients.
Simulating patients.
Mm-hmm. So that's another form of that, where you're helping people, although they're dealing with a particular medical situation that they're supposed to figure out. But I would think that the improv would help them think outside the box.
Absolutely. And I think in those standardized patient encounters are so valuable because, again, you lower the stakes. You're not actually ill. The challenge with them is, particularly for my learners, is they have to bring all their skills. So they're new to the medical world. So they're like in their, they have this Rolodex in their head that you could almost see flipping in their, behind their eyes as they're like, diabetes, what are the 10 things that I have to ask? You know, their eyes roll up to the ceiling as they like try to look for the answer. And they're supposed to act like a warm human being and have a conversation with you. And it's really hard. And part of the reason I started doing creating this work was I observed my wonderful, lovely, warm, gracious, eloquent medical students who you in the hallway, you'd be like, that young man or woman is just terrific. They would put on a short white coat and go to these standardized patient encounters and turn into robots. And it would be like, where is that young woman I just talked to in the hallway? She left, stayed in the hallway. And then doctor came in and there was a role that they were assuming that they were uncomfortable in. And also just the weight of their new knowledge had then boxed out all the human skills they had that they brought to the door of that room and left behind. And for me, medical improv was about to not say, oh, now you have to become a doctor, you know, fill in social role here and figure out what is that or occupy a role that perhaps you carried around in your head. The point is, how can you be your best, most professional and true version of yourself? How can you be the best version of yourself who also has a ton of medical knowledge, who someone has now come to trust and be vulnerable with? What do you already bring to bear, and how can you heighten that and enhance that?
How did you get interested in all of this? You're a lawyer by training. Mm-hmm. You're also an improv person, and you teach at Second City as well. Mm-hmm. How did all of it come to bear for you?
Yeah, it was serendipitous, as many of these things are, right? There was no 5-year plan that could include this. I was a lawyer, still am, and I took my first improv class thinking this would be good for my litigation skills. I had just moved to Chicago, saw improv for the first time, thought it was amazing, took a class, fell in love. So I thought that I had separate lives. I had a professional life, and then I had this theater work that I was taking more and more of my time, and I was falling in love with writing and sketch writing and playwriting and doing all sorts of things. And I was very busy with that. Around the same time, I did a fellowship in clinical medical ethics, and I became a bioethicist, and I joined the faculty at Northwestern. But I still thought this was very separate during my fellowship year. In my fellowship year, we have a program where we teach medical humanities seminars to students where they take a 10-hour seminar in their first and second year. And as a fellow, I got to create a seminar. And I did a different topic for my first seminar. Then I had the experience on Saturday nights, I was doing improv shows, and my boss started showing up. And for a lot of people, that's their nightmare, like I'm on stage without a script. For me, it was I'm on stage without a script, that's normal Saturday night, but my boss is in the audience, and so that was my nightmare. It turned out she was a theater fan, and it turned out she was interested in how doctors think. And when she was asking me, how in the world do you all do that? Of course you have something pre-prepared, right? And I was explaining, no, it's 45 minutes. It's long form. It's like a play. Characters come back. I just have to remember great detail. I have to, you know, I was explaining, because a lot of this is an oral tradition. There's more written now, but, you know, 10, 15 years ago, less so. It just was so similar to what physicians need to do with someone they don't know walking in the room, trying to figure out what is it we're going to do here today, build a story together, all those things. And so when I saw that phenomena in the medical students of how they became different people, in conversation with her, it became clear, I think that I know all, there's something I know from this other work that I saw as completely unrelated, that absolutely we could put this chocolate and this peanut butter and make something different and new that would be useful. So medical improv, I'm not teaching them to be funny. You know, people say like, oh, well, patients don't want to hear stand-up comedy. And I say, well, great, because that's not what we do. You know, we're not here to perform. You know, we're here to take the piece of improvisational theater that develops these essential skills and then translate that into the medical world. And that's what one branch of medical humanities does. You know, you might think about writing a narrative and teach that to doctors as a way for them to be attentive to storytelling and think about, when I write down patient reports, patient denies, I'm the narrator of a story in which I depict another character's actions. How have I done that? Who else gets to tell this story? Who speaks? So thinking about narrative analysis, that's a humanities approach to enhance medical skills. And medical improv is like that, too. So that's one branch, the sort of applied arts branch of the medical humanities. So for me, it was just being in the right place at the right time, being at a supportive institution that embraced medical humanities, and then having this arts life that I perceived as being completely unrelated, and having the opportunity to say, hey, I'm one person and I move to different spaces, but I can bring everything, each piece to the other side and integrate them as it is useful to others.
Now, you're doing this with medical students and, as you say, sometimes clinicians who are already practicing.
Yes.
Are you working with other medical professionals, nurses and PAs and even, you know, the person who comes to take your blood, the phlebotomist?
Yeah, on occasion. So there have been different opportunities. Often it's physicians, but there's one program at Indiana University in Indianapolis that is specifically training for teams. And so people have to come. It's a physician, a nurse, and either like a chaplain or a social worker who already work together as a team so they can build their teamwork skills in other ways. And then I've done trainings that have had multiple clinicians attend. For me, the way I can spread this work best is I do a train the trainer program. I've done it for 4 years. I had to skip last year. I'm doing it again this summer. And in that training, I get clinicians from all different fields. I've had pharmacists, dentists, nurses, physicians, social workers, you name it, come. And then they both take my course, and then I do a how to teach my course, completely second trained, and they do practice training on my wonderful medical student volunteers. And then they can go out and take my work and implement it where they are. So it's part of the curriculum at the UCLA School of Dentistry. There's an Arizona School of Physical Therapy that uses it. So the curriculum has been dispersed through these approximately 100 people throughout the country in other fields as well.
Is that something you're hoping to do here with the Medical College of Wisconsin?
It won't be today. I'm doing a lecture.
Right.
But who knows what the future holds? Because the idea is to, if I can train people to do it, then they can train a lot more people than I can. You know, I am a bioethicist and do other work as well. I wish I could do this full time, but I can't. But that's the way for me to train the trainer. Because the first time I published on it, I had physicians calling me saying, this sounds great. Can you send me your syllabus? And I said, first of all, it's not really that great of a syllabus. Second of all, it wouldn't make any sense. Third, have you ever taught improv? No. Have you ever done improv? No. Have you ever seen improv? No, but I could figure it out. Well, that's a terrific spirit, and I'm glad they thought it seemed useful, but it won't be successful. You know, and so I figured I've got to put my time where my mouth is. If they wanted, I need to train people to take those good intentions forward. And I've developed a big written thing and blah, blah, blah.
You know, it's funny. I have a theatrical background. Uh-huh. That was my major in undergraduate. And people often say, well, you know, what use is a theater degree going to do unless you're working in theater?
Sure.
And I said, you know, theater fits into everything in life because
mm-hmm.
it is an exploration of mm-hmm. everything mm-hmm. In human experience. And the way you've managed to put it together for this is just wonderful.
Oh, thank you. I agree with you. I think I don't have a theater degree. I envy you. I knew I would be going to law school to be a civil liberties lawyer. So, and I don't regret that one bit.
No, that's good too.
That's good too. Yep. I maintain that is important. And I treasure my work in bioethics and I work in reproductive justice. So that's my content area in bioethics right now. But I think a theater degree is a psychology degree. It is a literature degree. And it is a PE degree all wrapped up in one, right?
And performance and yep. art appreciation.
Yes.
It's
so interdisciplinary that we don't think of it as such usually.
Right.
You know? And
right.
fashion, if you got to do the costume course.
Exactly. Fashion and how
history.
Light works. History. There's so much mm-hmm. that it pulls in mm-hmm. That it's a perfect platform to do this kind of work, too.
Well, and I think theater and medicine, and Bonnie, this is exciting in our conversation to come up on new things because, you know, you think you've thought about something a lot, and then every time you chat about it, something new comes up. What you're pointing up to me is theater is all about that slice of life. When you write a play, it's why are we here now? Why these people and why at this moment? And theater is usually about heightened experiences, the moment when, the night it was different, the person who, or it's a slice of life that says something really important about who we are and quotes around we, whoever the we is. But it's distilled. We only have an hour or two together. It's not the drip drip of we're going to watch this character put on her socks and make her sandwich, right? Medicine's like that too. People come for that moment, that slice. Tonight is the night in the emergency room. Everything is different. This is the season we're going to treat that cancer. This is the season we're going to say goodbye to mom. You know, it may not be 2 hours long, but it is often peak moments or essential blocks of time, life-altering forks in the road in medicine. And I think theater and a training in theater and appreciation of theater captures that essential heightened human thing. What is both so specific to the character and yet universal to us all is the best theater often. And in medicine, capturing, you know, what is specific to Bonnie and what is it about that brought her tonight that is universal to human suffering and human healing.
To all of us. Mm-hmm. Exactly. And finding the universal in the specific.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Katie Watson, we could keep talking.
We could, and we might. Let's turn off the microphone.
Yes. But have a wonderful time here in Milwaukee.
It's such a treat to be here. The Medical College of Wisconsin is fantastic. And the fact that they've done so much work embracing the medical humanities really sets them apart nationally.
And it's wonderful to have you as a representative of that here in the studio. Thank you.
Thanks so much.
Dr. Katie Watson is a professor of law, ethics, and humanities at Northwestern University and an adjunct associate professor of medical education and obstetrics and gynecology at Northwestern's Feinberg School of Medicine.
She's also an adjunct on the teaching faculty at Chicago's Second City. She was in Milwaukee in the fall to give the Medical College of Wisconsin's annual medical humanities lecture. You can find links about everything she does at WUWM.com.
The latest episode of X-Fabula is next as Lake Effect Weekend continues in just a moment on WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.
Three, two, one.
Welcome to X-Fabula!
True personal stories.
X-Fabula!
X-Fabula is a Milwaukee nonprofit committed to strengthening community bonds through the art of storytelling.
And time for another edition of X-Fabula Radio on Lake Effect Weekend. I'm Rachel Owens, and joining us is X-Fabula co-founder Leah Delaney. Welcome back.
Well, thank you so much. How's it going by you?
Oh, it's going great. When the sun is shining, it's warm. Yeah. It's not felt like January lately.
I know, but you know, it's going to trick you. We're going to get dumped on probably in the middle of April or May this year. We'll see what happens. But I got to tell you, I agree with you on that whole sun thing. Like, it could literally be tornadoing outside or anything. Just as long as the sun is out, I'm fine. It's these gray, dreary days that really get me going. It's like the Game of Thrones 7-year winter from like January 1st up to like April 30th, you know? But luckily we have stories to sort of get us through the dreary times.
Yes, and stories that are perfect for this weather. A little something for everybody, whether you love the winter and love when it snows, don't want it to end, or if you're someone who wants to
get out of Dodge.
Yeah.
Yeah. And in fact, one of each today. So let's just jump right into those stories. Our first story is that person who wants to get out of Dodge. Let's listen to Sandy Bruzine's story, who told hers at the Perfect Storm Story Slam back in 2016. Here's Sandy.
Imagine it's summer. It's July. It's a beautiful day in Milwaukee. The sun is shining. The sky is blue. Everything's perfect. And I'm going to meet my husband at an airport in Newark, New Jersey. He's been away studying for 2 weeks at Hebrew Institute at Brandeis University. Not a Hebrew Institute. It was an institute on Israel studies. So he was there for 2 weeks, and I was home with workmen who were working on my kitchen that was being remodeled at the time. And naturally, everything that could go wrong had gone wrong. But the 2 weeks had passed, And I was finally going to leave my kitchen that was still in a state of disarray to go meet my husband that I hadn't seen in 2 weeks. I flew to O'Hare Airport to transfer to the plane that was going to take me to Newark. And it was a beautiful day in Chicago. But it was not a beautiful day in Newark. The plane that I was scheduled to fly on was canceled. It was delayed. And I thought, oh, no problem. It was morning, and I didn't have to be there till 4 in the afternoon. So everything would work out. Well, I went up the next scheduled time to leave. And again, I was told the storms were continuing. I couldn't board the plane again. I started getting nervous. I'm not going to make it. It happened a third time. I couldn't board the plane. There were still storms out there on the East Coast. At that point, I decided I better call my son, who was at work at the time, and tell him that if Dad should call you, you'll explain to him I couldn't make it because I couldn't get on the plane in Chicago to see him. He said to me, don't be silly. You're going to make it. Everything's going to be okay. I said, I don't know. They keep postponing this flight. I'm never going to get there. He said, don't worry. You're going to make it. Well, finally, at the last possible moment, it was okay. And I boarded this plane to go to Newark. And I'm aboard the plane. It taxis out onto the runway. And you guessed it, we couldn't move. We had to stay out there on the runway. More storms had started. At this point, I figured I'm never going to make it. And by now, you know, I figured I have to contact my husband. And I didn't have one of those phones that now we call them smartphones. I didn't have even a cell phone. I had nothing. So I asked this nice man sitting next to me on the plane, could I borrow your phone to call my son to tell him that when my husband calls, he'll be able to tell him I couldn't make it. We're on the runway. So I call my son, and it was one of those moments. My son said to me, Mom, get a hold of yourself. Do exactly what I'm going to tell you to do. You asked to see the chief flight attendant, and you tell her what your problem is. You tell her that when you land, you have to know exactly where to go and how to go, and just do exactly what I'm telling you. So, you know, I did what my son said for the first time in my life. I got up there. I asked, I need to speak to the head of all of the flight attendants. She said to me, no problem. The flight took off. And when we landed, the flight attendant gets on and said, everybody, hold on to your seats. Don't get up. We have someone who has to make a connection. And it was just like the movies. I stood up. I ran out of the plane. I ran through the you know, all the security and everything, holding my shoes in my hand. And there was my husband waiting for me. Of course, my luggage did not arrive in Israel with me, but I was able to share a new intimacy with my husband. I wore his underwear that whole week.
And that was Sandy Bruzine's story about taking a jet plane out of here.
I could see why she became the audience favorite right away.
Yep, most definitely. I love it. I love it when first-timers get up on stage and then just blow everyone's socks off and then they go away with the crown for the night. Speaking of story slams and crowns and such, we have another story slam coming up on February 7th. We are going to be back at the Lakefront Brewery. This time, the theme is first time. Take that interpretation as you wish, Milwaukee, and show up to Lakefront Brewery with an empty hand and a story ready to be told. Because we'll be picking names out of the hat, per usual, getting people up on stage. And again, just like Sandy Bruzine, you could be one of the audience favorites and get crowned and walk away with a whole bunch of pride and bragging rights to being the audience favorite for a Story Slam at X Fabula.
Sounds great. So for the next one, though, someone who actually does love the winter weather and winter sports.
Yes. Let's listen to Rebecca Siegel's story. She told this at our Green Story Slam back in March of 2013. Here's Rebecca.
When someone asks you, have you skied? There are two appropriate responses, yes or no, because that's realistically the answer to a yes or no question. If someone asks you, do you ski, as in, are you a skier, there should also probably be two appropriate responses, yes or no. I, after graduating college with my double major in theater and French, a.k.a. my serving degree, I... One time, I like that one. I went to teach English in France for 2 years because I was very ambitious and I love French and cheese and France. And the second year I was there, I was living in Grenoble, which is the valley of the beautiful mountain region near the Alps. So I had a friend whose boyfriend at the time, his parents were smart enough to have purchased a unit or I don't know, an apartment at one of those chalets at Marybelle, which to me meant nothing, but to the skiing world, it's like the best resort. So all of a sudden, here I am, I've got this free ticket for a week at Marybelle. And so my friend Sarah was like, do you ski? And I was like, yeah, kinda. she only heard the first part. The kinda was relating to the fact that I had skied 3 times in my life, once in the mountains of Wisconsin, Alpine Valley, twice also in the mountains of Wisconsin, Alpine Valley, both with my father, both on little, very short hills. Third time, my first year in France, in this place called D, spelled die, I kid you not, D-I-E. We're going to D today. So all our Facebook status is, we're going to die today. That was cool, but of course I went down only the green slopes because I had never skied a mountain before in my entire life. So now I have 3 under my belt. Now I'm in the mountains. Just thousands and thousands and thousands of feet up in the air. And the group that I was with were all pro skiers. They've been skiing from the womb and came out with, like, in this position. And I think they skied out of the womb, actually. So they're like, yeah, we're going to the top today. Come on. I'm like, oh, guys. They're like, what? I'm like, I'm a beginner skier. I can only ski the green paths. I can only do that. And they're like, no, unacceptable. You're never going to learn until you try. I'm like, okay. All right. I feel like you all know where this is going. So I'm like shaking thinking about this, literally. So we go up and up and up and up and up and up and up to the freaking top of the mountain. Now here's the thing, sidebar, being at the top of this mountain was probably in that frame of like, I don't care what happens next, one of the most beautiful, serene moments of my entire life. I don't think there's anything, I don't care if you believe in God or you believe in whatever, veganism, I don't, whatever, but... there's nothing that comes close to this. I mean, the cool, crisp air, like just pink, purple, blue, just the color's incredible. Oh my God, it was worth it. And then we had to get back down. There's no, you can't get back on the lift to go down. They won't let you. I tried, trust me, I asked. So I was like, guys, really, I can't do a black or a blue. They're like, that's fine, we'll take you down the red, and I'll switch that, blue. It's one step up from the green. Like, okay, so sorry. So black is really, apparently in France it's different. Black is the hardest, red is second hardest, blue is second easiest, green is easiest on a mountain, which means that it's really not easy at all. So they're trying to like coach me and teach me while I'm at the top. And the red path, the blue path that we were going to take, that we actually got me down, like, intercepted with the red path, and like a Bugs Bunny cartoon, the sign was covered in snow. So all of a sudden, we're going down, and I'm like, why is this getting harder? Oh my God! And as I'm asking the question, they're like, I'm gone. I'm literally like this. Ah! I'm like, If you are the mountain, this is me. Because I was sliding down. I wish I could have seen myself sliding down in my snowsuit, with, like, holding on for dear life. There's nothing above me. I'm just seeing everything drip away from me. And then I turn around. I'm like sliding, just falling. All the hot French guys are laughing at me. And I finally have it in my mind. I don't know where my skis are, to like stick my boot in the snow and stop myself. And my friend Sarah just goes, "Hey, are you okay?" And almost okay. So I'm sitting there, I'm like blubbering. I'm like, "Oh my God." And she goes, "Becca." She's like, "You only fell down like this much. The rest of it was this much, and you skied. Now turn around." I was like, "Okay." She says, "Look at what you did. Look at what you just did. You just skied down that." And I looked up and I was like, "Oh my God, I did." I told my mother, she's like, "You could have broken a leg." I'm like, "Yeah, I recognize that. So I'll probably never do this again because I like my legs." But there are not many moments in my life where I could be that accidentally proud of myself. And so I went from green in Wisconsin to red in the Alps in France, and I survived to tell about it. Thank you.
And that was Rebecca Siegel's story. Holy cats, that's one thing. I think I missed my window of opportunity to like get back into skiing. Like, just terrifies me.
I'm just glad I learned when I was a kid, because then I loved it. But still, those moments when you're just like, "Oh my God, am I going to make it down to the end of the trail in one piece?"
And that Bugs Bunny moment with the snow-covered sign. Like,
yes, I think we've all had one of those. So I'm happy with cross-country skiing at this point.
Sure, yeah. Just flatlands all the way. Which brings us to the end of another Exfabula radio show. So sad. We'll be back next weekend, though.
Yes. And in the meantime, for people to check out online, you do have a few more events coming up.
We do. We have a public storytelling workshop that's going to be on February 10th. And let us not forget the February Story Slam on February 7th at Lakefront Brewery. First time is the theme. Should be a good night of stories, for sure.
That sounds like a great theme. All right. Well, thank you so much, Leah. Hope you're enjoying the warm and the cold weather to some extent. And look forward to seeing you again next week.
Perfect.
Exfabula is a regular feature on Lake Effect Weekend, and it wraps up our show today. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Bonnie North. Thank you so much for making us a part of your afternoon. Lake Effect Weekend airs every Saturday and Sunday from 3 to 4. Be sure to tune into the weekday version of our show as well at 10 in the morning.
It is all on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio, NPR in Milwaukee. Stay tuned now. Weekend All Things Considered comes your way next. It's 4 o'clock.